healthy childhood. And that does it for our show. We have these two breaking stories. House Speaker Paul Ryan's reportedly not going to run for re-election in November. He's leaving the House of Representatives. And this news out of Algeria. Up to 257 people have died in an Algerian military plane crash near Algiers this morning. Among the dead are reportedly 26 members of the Polisario Front, which is seeking Western Sahara's independence from Morocco. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for our paid year-long social media fellowship. Details at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottes, Diener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Caron. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. It is 5 o'clock, and coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Is Home Birthright for Me? On Sunday, April 15th at 5 p.m. at the Northeast Whole Foods Market in Portland, 3535 Northeast 15th Avenue. Local home birth midwives will show the film, Why Not Home, followed by a QA session with the midwives. Again, that's Is Home Birthright for Me? On Sunday, April 15th at 5 p.m. at Whole Foods Market, 3535 Northeast 15th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Benefit on Friday, April 13th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Laven Community Center in Portland. The Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project has been working to protect and restore the ecosystems of the Blue Mountains and Eastern Oregon Cascades since 1991. This annual fundraiser features performances by the bands Na Rosé and Dolphin Midwives, as well as food, drink, and presentations from directors Karen Coulter and Paula Hood. Again, that's the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Benefit on Friday, April 13th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Laven Community Center, 5431 Northeast 20th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, President Trump has appointed an opponent of the Endangered Species Act to be the Interior Department's Assistant Secretary of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks.
Speaker of the House Paul Ryan announced today that he would not seek re-election in November and would retire in January.
And between 109th and 167th Avenues, the speed limit on Stark will be reduced from 35 to 30 miles per hour.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 11th, 2018. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael feels a little like Trump today. So many targets, so little time.
Today, Paul Ryan and Florida Rep. Dennis Ross said they won't be coming back. Over 40 House Republicans not seeking re-election, around triple the usual number. Not rats abandoning a sinking ship, but pirates who've looted enough to leave Washington for places where thievery's not in the national spotlight. Where's the spotlight today? Is that a spotlight or laser targeting? Donnie's cried wolf so many times, rattled so many sabers. Is he serious now? Or is it just another distraction from Stormy Daniels, from Pruitt, DeVos, and Bolton? I can't tell the distractions from the threats anymore. Threatening Syria is threatening Russia, which maybe Trump's doing to show there's no collusion. Making sense isn't an option here. Trade war with China, nuclear war with North Korea, information war with Sinclair and Fox versus reality. At least I'm at peace with having my information loose on the internet. Mark Zuckerberg said he's sorry, and that makes everything okay. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Two of Portland's 10 traffic fatalities this year happened along a stretch of Southeast Stark, so the city is taking action there. Between 109th to 162nd Avenues, the speed limit on Stark will be reduced from 35 to 30 miles per hour. The City Transportation Bureau will install new pedestrian crossings at 146th, 151st, and 160th Avenues this year, and will set up red light and speed limit cameras at 122nd, and 148th Avenues. Transportation Director Leah Treat said, "We have found that when we reduce the speed limit and have it backed up by an enforcement method, it's way more effective."
Portland hipsters who want to live the stereotype to the fullest just have to move north across the Columbia. According to MoveHub's U.S. Hipster Index, Vancouver, Washington is number one, scoring 8.2. The list is based on the number of microbreweries, thrift stores, vegan restaurants, and tattoo parlors per 100,000 residents, as well as rent inflation. Portland blessedly came in 12th place, rated less hipsterish than Tacoma, Boise, or Salt Lake City, which finished second on the list.
Though natural gas makes for a bridge fuel from coal and oil, it doesn't compare to renewable energy. KBOO reporter Kyle Carrezzi, in conjunction with Oregon News Service, has more.
Natural gas has been hailed as a potential bridge fuel for the country as it transitions from coal and oil to renewable energy. Spokesperson Anna Fahey for Northwest Environmental Research Group says the news media often overlooks natural gas's dirty secret. Natural gas often is described as, quote, burning cleaner than coal or oil, said Anna Fahey, director of strategic communications for the Sightline Institute. While it's true that natural gas releases half as much carbon dioxide as coal at combustion and far less particulate matter than coal or oil, Fahey said the bigger issue is methane, which traps 86 times as much heat in the atmosphere as does carbon dioxide.
The problem is that you don't even have to burn natural gas. It doesn't need to be combusted to be a potent greenhouse gas, because the bulk of it is methane, and methane leaks at every stage of the gas's life.
Fahey cited a recent Associated Press story about a proposed liquefied natural gas pipeline and export facility at Jordan Cove on the southern Oregon coast that described natural gas as, quote, cleaner burning and more efficient. However, it didn't include the effects of methane. She also noted that 70% of natural gas in the United States is fracked. Fahey said money spent on infrastructure such as the Gordon Cove pipeline could lock the nation into decades of using natural gas, when that money could be used to build infrastructure for clean fuel sources such as wind or solar.
Natural gas, or what we like to call fracked methane gas now, is actually stalling progress on the real fuels of the future and the ones that are going to transition us off fossil fuels.
According to Bloomberg New Energy Finance, the gas industry was responsible for more emissions than the coal industry for the first time last year. An article by Fahey is online at Sightline.org. From KBOO Evening News, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, I'm Kyle Carrezzi.
Speaker of the House Paul Ryan announced today that he would not seek re-election in November and would retire in January. An hour after Ryan, Florida Republican Dennis Ross also announced he would not be back in Congress, bringing the number of Republican congresspeople not returning next term to over 40. To regain control of Congress, Democrats need to win 19 more seats in November than they currently hold. House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, a Republican from California, and House Majority Whip Steve Scalise of Louisiana are currently frontrunners to replace Ryan as House Speaker. Ryan said he's leaving Congress to spend more time with his family.
Reaffirming his skill at finding the worst possible candidate for the job, President Trump has appointed an opponent of the Endangered Species Act to be the Interior Department's Assistant Secretary of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. As Texas State Comptroller, Susan Combs regularly went against one of the agencies she's slated to head, opposing rulings that would be barriers to the oil industry and others. Combs once labeled animals included on the official endangered list as, quote, incoming Scud missiles. Due to technical rules, Combs would serve in this position on an interim basis until the Senate votes her in on her appointment. Last summer, she was named the Assistant Secretary for Policy Management and Budget for the Interior Department, but the Senate has yet to confirm her for a number of reasons, including strong opposition from conservation organizations.
Today was part two of Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg's testimony on the security of Facebook users' privacy. He faced the House of Representatives instead of the Senate this time, and he also faced a tougher line of questions. The testimony came from the Cambridge Analytica scandal, where Facebook exchanged the data and online habits of over 80 million users to be made into complex psychological profiles to designate the target voting audience for the Trump presidential campaign. The testimony lasted for 6 hours in front of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. The testimony raised many questions about Facebook's approach to privacy and how Facebook fits into society.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Hannah Colton, in for Antonia Gonzalez. Members of the Yurok tribe in Northern California headed to federal court Wednesday to attend a hearing that could affect salmon in the Klamath River. KIEM-TV reports a federal district court judge will decide whether the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation has to release more water this spring and summer in order to protect juvenile salmon from a deadly pathogen. Upstream farmers and other users oppose the court-mandated water release. Yurok Tribal Chairman Thomas P. O'Rourke said in a press release that salmon are an essential part of the tribe's way of life and that the current drought makes them vulnerable to crisis-level disease rates. Wednesday's hearing is the latest in a decade-long dispute over Klamath River water. The Yurok tribe canceled commercial fishing last year due to declining king salmon populations. The Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior Chippewa is the latest Wisconsin tribe to file a lawsuit against the makers and distributors of opioid prescription drugs. Glenn Moberg reports.
The 77-page lawsuit was filed in federal court against both drug manufacturers and stores like Walmart, Walgreens, and CVS that fill prescriptions. The suit alleges that the Lac du Flambeau tribe has suffered significant costs for medical treatment, child welfare, foster care, education, addiction therapy, and the care of babies born addicted. Attorney Andrew Adams says close-knit tribal communities are hit hard when individual members get hooked.
The products are so addictive, and for a tribal community, when an individual is impacted, it has a cascading effect. Then it impacts all the people around them, and then it impacts the health of the tribal community itself.
Opioid lawsuits have also been filed by the Lac-Couturier Band, the Menominee Tribe, and the St. Croix Chippewa. Glenn Moberg, Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Recently, tribes in Oklahoma, the Dakotas, and Wyoming have also filed lawsuits related to opioid drug addiction. Lawmakers in Maine have rejected the latest effort to move toward tribal gaming development. The State House on Monday narrowly voted down a proposal to ask the state Supreme Court for advice on whether tribes could open casinos without state approval. Representative Henry John Baer of the Holton Band of Maliseet Indians argued that tribal casino revenues would benefit both the state economy and the well-being of tribal members.
We have health issues, education issues. The budget doesn't cover it. We have housing shortages. We need jobs, and we want to pay our own way. That's the simple response to questions to us. Why do you want to do this? Why gaming? It will raise critical revenues that will not otherwise be generated in the remote areas where we're located.
The issue goes back to a 1987 U.S. Supreme Court decision from California that held tribes could operate casinos if the state where their reservation is located allows them. Representative Baer's attempt to take the matter to Maine's highest court died in the state house. Maine already has two private casinos. Numerous attempts to approve tribal gaming facilities have failed in recent years. As some in the U.S. recognize Equal Pay Day, advocates are pointing out that wage disparities are even greater for Native Americans and other women of color. April 10th this year symbolically marked when a woman would have earned what a man earned in 2017. But the National Women's Law Center noted that for Native women, Equal Pay Day isn't until the end of September. Stephanie Poston owns a public relations firm based on the Sandia Pueblo in New Mexico. On Native America Calling Tuesday, she acknowledged the pay gap and encouraged Native women to stick to what they believe their work is worth.
To know your worth and stand by it with confidence. As Native people, we have a very unique lens that we work from. You know, I worked for my tribe for 11 years. I learned so much and I'm so grateful for the opportunity. But it's really important that we, as Native women, know our worth and stand by it.
Native American women earn just 57 cents for every dollar earned by their white male counterparts. For National Native News, I'm Hannah Colton.
Now it's time for the daily national newscast from the Public News Service. The Public News Service has bureaus in 36 states dedicated to news in the public interest.
The Public News Service daily newscast for Wednesday, April the 11th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. Want the odds of Facebook being regulated? Stay tuned. Also on the rundown, teachers in Arizona stage walk-ins to demand higher pay, and Washington, the first state in the nation to reduce bias in jury selection. Topping our news, will Facebook be regulated? CNET reports CEO Mark Zuckerberg opened the door Tuesday, telling Congress he'd welcome regulation if it's the right regulation. He testified before a joint hearing of the Senate Judiciary Committee and Senate Committee on Commerce Tuesday. He'll make a similar appearance today before the House Energy and Commerce Committee. At all of these hearings, CNET says Zuckerberg wants to reassure lawmakers, investors, advertisers, not to mention Facebook's 2.2 billion users, that the social network can be trusted with their data. They're calling them walk-ins as Arizona teachers across the state protest today to demand higher pay. Catherine Davis Young reports about 1,000 public schools are expected to participate.
Teachers, along with staff, parents, and community members, say they'll march arm in arm into schools before the start of the day as a show of solidarity. Their demands include 20% raises, smaller class sizes, and no new tax cuts until Arizona's per-student spending reaches the national average. Noah Carvelis, an elementary school music teacher in suburban Phoenix, is with Arizona Educators United, a group organizing the walk-ins.
We think that that's going to be a very powerful thing to show that community support behind us and what we ultimately need to see, our answers. We need to see something change. We can't maintain the status quo like our governor is trying to.
Governor Doug Ducey has said a 20% raise, which would cost more than $600 million, is out of the question. Teachers got a 1% raise last year, and Ducey's proposed budget allows for another 1% this year. He has vowed not to raise taxes or reverse any corporate tax breaks that he's created since taking office.
Arizona Educated United formed just a few weeks ago, drawing inspiration from teachers who staged a successful labor strike in West Virginia. Arizona teachers say they hope they can reach a deal with the state without a strike. Civil liberties advocates are calling a bill passed Monday by Pennsylvania's Health Committee unconstitutional and unenforceable.
House Bill 2050 would make it a crime to perform an abortion based on a fetal diagnosis of Down syndrome. Elizabeth Randall, legislative director for the ACLU of Pennsylvania, notes that other states have passed similar laws, but none have gone into effect.
It attempts to ban abortion prior to viability and beginning in Roe v. Wade all the way through subsequent Supreme Court decisions. That has been repeatedly affirmed flatly unconstitutional.
Supporters of the bill say people with Down syndrome can lead happy lives and contribute to their communities. HB 2050 could come up for a final vote in the House next week. There is no similar bill in the Senate. I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
A federal court stopped implementation of a similar law in Indiana in 2016. Groups opposed to construction of a storage facility for spent nuclear fuel from the nation's commercial reactors are on tour this week to make sure people know what's being proposed for southern New Mexico. Here's Ross Brown.
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is considering a proposal from Holtec International to build and transport the waste now stored in casks at various nuclear power plants around the country to southern New Mexico. Don Hancock with the Southwest Research and Information Center says New Mexico shouldn't be the repository for 60 years worth of nuclear waste generated on the East Coast.
The proposal is to bring all that currently exists. So if this were to happen, the place where all this waste would be is in New Mexico as opposed to now when it's in more than 30 other states and none in New Mexico.
The Holtec facility could store up to 100,000 tons of nuclear reactor waste for as long as 120 years or until a permanent repository is built.
Immigrants advocates are meeting this week to determine their next move as they protest the indefinite detention of Somali immigrants in Florida. Isra Ibrahim is a student organizer at Florida International University, along with the Muslim American Society of South Florida. She organized a protest last weekend at the Chrome Detention Center. She says about 90 Somalis are being detained in Florida for running afoul of President Donald Trump's so-called Muslim ban that singled out immigrants from Sudan and Somalia.
What ICE is doing to these detainees is unconstitutional and just racist, just flat out racist based on where they are from and the fact that they don't have citizenship, but, you know, they're immigrants.
She says they're asking for the release of the Somali immigrants being held in Florida. Another 80 are being held at a West Texas detention center. And finally, Eric Tegenhoff tells us Washington is set to become the first state to tackle racial bias in the jury selection process.
The new rule, which goes into effect at the end of April, bars attorneys from excluding someone not only for intentional racial bias, but also implicit, institutional, and unconscious bias. The decision gives teeth to a 1986 U.S. Supreme Court ruling, Batson v. Kentucky, which allows lawyers to object if they suspect a person is being ruled out because of their race. Sal Mungia, an attorney who helped draft the new rule alongside ACLU Washington, says the Batson decision has been hard to enforce because lawyers have to prove that the challenge to a potential juror was a racist act.
So it takes the pressure off of everyone and makes it a very low bar to ensure that, one, we have a more diverse jury panel, and two, that people who in fact show up to do their civic duty don't get excluded from doing that because of the color of their skin.
The hope is the rule can serve as a model for other states. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo. At 6, it's Right to Survive. That's followed at 7 by Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather is a 90% chance of showers with a low of 40. Tomorrow, there's an 80% chance of showers, high of 51, and increasing winds. Today in history, in 1970, Apollo 13 was launched from Cape Canaveral. 2 days later, the capsule developed problems, scratching the moon landing. The three astronauts had to MacGyver replacement equipment so they could survive the trip back to Earth, where they landed on April 17th. Quote of the day is from Tom Hanks, one of the stars of the Apollo 13 movie. If you're funny, if there's something that makes you laugh, then every day's going to be okay.
It's time now for weekly commentary from Jim Hightower.
Greed is good, proclaimed Gordon Gekko, lead character in a 1987 film lampooning the low ethics of the high finance barons of Wall Street. You might think that surely this Hollywood portrayal is a gross exaggeration, but check out an egregious example of Gekko-level greed being pushed by today's Wall Street sharks. Big shot financiers have been going all out to kill a sensible Labor Department rule meant to protect people's retirement accounts from the self-serving guile of financial manipulators. The rule simply requires firms that manage these accounts to put our money in investments expected to produce the best returns for us, rather than in investments that pay the highest interest fees to them. It's hardly harsh to require them to treat us common customers with basic honesty, applying what amounts to a golden rule for bankers. But, oh, howls of outrage exploded from the Wall Street baronies. Lobbyists swarmed into Washington, and scores of lawyers rushed into courts. To defend their right to be dishonest, the greed-fueled bankers resorted to more dishonesty, claiming that the fiduciary rule would hurt, quote, smaller investors. Huh? Well, they prevaricated. Only by misdirecting small retirement savers into high-fee investments can we make enough profit to give, quote, affordable financial advice to workaday folks. Again, huh? These banks are wallowing in unconscionable levels of profits, but the only affordable advice they want to offer us is bad advice, funneling our retirement stash into deals that benefit them at our expense. This is Jim Hightower saying, bankers claiming that they have a legal right to profit by cheating their own customers is a level of gluttony so gross that it would even gag Gordon Gekko. For more information, go to consumerfed.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Now it's time for This Week in Water, produced by H2O Radio.
Pruitt grabs control of water regulation as ethics allegations swirl. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
As he was defending himself from a barrage of ethics complaints, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt declared last week that he is now the final authority on Clean Water Act decisions in regulating pollution.
Technically speaking, he made himself the decision maker over what's called geographic jurisdiction, the determination of which bodies of water are protected under the Act.
In the past, decisions about application of the Clean Water Act have been left to field offices of the EPA because deciding what's appropriate depends on local circumstances, according to former EPA career employee Betsy Sutherland, who spoke to Vox.
A spokesperson for the Sierra Club told Inside Climate News that the reason Pruitt has retained control is to allow the agency to hand over a lot of natural resources to polluting interests.
Among the ethical issues Pruitt faces is his use of Safe Drinking Water Act funds to increase the salaries of two people he brought to EPA with him from Oklahoma. The Atlantic reports that the White House had disapproved the pay boosts, but Pruitt went forward anyway in a manner that did not require presidential or congressional approval.
In North Carolina, a trial began last week to determine if hog farms have to pay nearby homeowners for foul-smelling air.
10 families will attempt to prove that pig waste lagoons and the smell of dead hogs plague their properties to the point they can't even sit outside.
There are about 2,100 farms and 9 million pigs, mainly in the southeast part of the Tar Heel State, almost as many animals as people. All the swine waste, unlike that of most humans, goes into open-air pits where the feces and urine stand untreated and break down to some extent.
According to the publication Modern Farmer, the pits leak toxic waste into the environment besides smelling insanely bad. The remnants are liquefied and then sprayed onto nearby crops.
A study from the University of North Carolina linked air pollution from the hog farms to reduced lung function, anxiety, and mucous membrane irritation.
The North Carolina study also found that the hog operations disproportionately affect people of color. The trial is expected to last another 5 weeks.
From the end of October until the middle of March, no rain or snow fell in Beijing, China, its longest drought on record.
Despite the lack of precipitation, people in the city did not undergo any disruptions to their water service. The Economist reports that most of Beijing's drinking water comes from a canal and pipeline system that travels nearly 900 miles.
South to North, as it's called, is the largest diversion in the world from one basin to another, and as the Economist notes, it addresses China's worst environmental threat, not horrible air quality, but lack of water.
Nearly 70% of Beijing's water needs are currently met by the South to North project, but China's needs are growing fast. Other sources are groundwater, which has been overpumped, leading to land subsidence and seawater intrusion.
The project has had effects on rivers in the south. Less water in them is resulting in wetlands drying and contaminants building up.
The increasing dryness, or aridification, of the southwest U.S. has led to an 18-year period of low river and stream flows in parts of the Colorado River Basin. Another basin that is experiencing the lack of water is the Rio Grande.
The Rio Grande is the third largest river in the lower 48, running 1,900 miles. It supplies 6 million people with water and irrigates 2 million acres.
In spring, the Rio Grande usually swells with runoff, but according to New Mexico Political Report, the middle portion of the river has already dried up.
It isn't unusual for the river to run dry for distances up to 90 miles, but this condition happening in April is unprecedented.
Because of the lack of water, biologists have relocated about 15,000 silvery minnows to places where the river is running, and the Bureau of Reclamation is working with other agencies to create a pulse flow.
There's been a lot of focus on plastic pollution in the Earth's oceans recently, but a report out last week in Science Advances shows it's affecting freshwater and land.
Compost collected from homes and grocery stores is a source of microplastic particles less than 5 millimeters in length.
When compost is spread over fields, it contains plastics that can be eaten by worms, gets into waterways, and even becomes airborne.
The greatest amount of microplastics was from grocery store waste. A researcher who was not involved in the study told Science News that it made sense. For instance, a crate of rotting cucumbers wrapped in plastic doesn't just disappear.
And finally, Henry David Thoreau spent 2 years at Walden Pond pondering how to live life simply. During his stay, starting in 1854, he wrote that the water was so transparent the bottom could easily be seen even 30 feet below the surface.
But oh, how things change. Since then, human activity, from pesticide use, seeping landfills, deforestation, and heavy use by tourists, has altered Walden's ecosystem, according to a new study.
Tourists are taking the biggest toll, say researchers from Paul Smith College. People recreating near the pond are eroding trails and sending sediment into the water. But another thing they deposit into the lake? Urine.
Yes, people are peeing in the water, adding phosphorus to the pond, which is spurring the growth of phytoplankton. Plankton populations have increased significantly since the 1920s, when beach and bathhouse facilities popped up along the pond shores, bringing more swimmers, resulting in murkier, greener waters.
Climate change will exacerbate the situation. Not only will warmer, longer summers likely result in more recreational use, but they'll also create conditions conducive to the growth of plankton.
So what to do, other than encouraging people not to pee in the pond? Perhaps we can quote Thoreau himself, who said, "We can never have enough of nature," and add that in many cases, nature could have a little less of us.
That's it for This Week in Water. We'll see you next time. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, bringing together the best and brightest minds in the water sector at ACE 18. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE18.
Would using the "my dog ate my homework" excuse be a good legal defense? Well, it did not work for 8 Argentinian police officers who were fired after claiming mice had eaten over half a ton of cannabis in an evidence locker warehouse outside of Buenos Aires. The pot had been in storage for over 2 years. 6 tons of it are still there. Forensic experts told the court they doubted even a large number of rodents could have eaten so much marijuana, and if they had, a lot of corpses would have been found in that warehouse.
24 years ago, on April 6, 1994, a Rwandan president and Burundian president were assassinated in a rocket attack on their plane, which crashed into the Rwandan presidential palace in Rwanda's capital, Kigali. The ensuing war and massacres came to be known as the Rwandan genocide. Ann Garrison from KPFA Berkeley has some commentary on an interview from President Paul Kagame, the current president of Rwanda.
24 years ago, on April 6, 1994, Rwandan President Juvenal Habyarimana and Burundian President Cyprien Ntaryamira were assassinated in a rocket attack on their plane, which crashed into the Rwandan presidential palace in Rwanda's capital, Kigali. The 90 days of war and massacres that ensued came to be known as the Rwanda genocide. Much of the ongoing argument as to what happened, who killed who, and for what purpose has focused on the question of who assassinated the two presidents, who fired the rocket at the plane, on whose orders. This is a clip of BBC Hard Talk host Stephen Secours' 2006 interview with Rwandan President Paul Kagame on the question.
I'm the president of Rwanda. I'm a Rwandese. I had a right. I had the basis for getting involved in the armed struggle to liberate my country from Habyarimana, from the government he was leading. I've been a refugee outside Rwanda for 30 years.
But you didn't have a right to shoot down his plane and to assassinate him.
Well, I had a right to fight for my rights.
But do you believe you had a right to assassinate him?
No. But of course, Habyarimana, having been on the other side that I was fighting, it was possible that he could easily die. Imagine if I had died myself in the same process. Would the same judge be asking about my death, about who killed me?
But
so
Rwandans,
I'm saying this is a situation where there was a war that was being fought. But this has nothing to do now with who actually killed Habyarimana yet. I'm not even coming to that. I'm only saying, is it even surprising that somebody involved in a war can die? But does that also mean that you simply bring up world allegations against
him? Sorry to interrupt, but you were involved in a peace negotiation with him at the time. Yeah. The RPF was talking to him.
Yes, and the genocide happened well after that as well. We had a genocide.
You call them wild allegations, but of course you know that they're not wild allegations. You know that Judge Jean-Louis Bruguière has been working on this case for many, many years. You also know he's one of the most respected judges in all of France.
He has a track record of tracking down terrorists,
bringing them to justice. Yeah. He's been working on your case, and he has, and I have it here, about 70 pages of documentary evidence pointing to your
guilt. No, this is 70 pages of trash, of nothing, and I show that. look at the people he's talking about, he talked to, that he got testimonies from. Almost all of them are people who are indicted by International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. People who, in fact, are wanted by the tribunal, but they can't have access to them, or they can't get hold of them. Yet the judge has access to them because they enjoy protection in France.
Judge Rubier comes up with this conclusion. The final order to attack the presidential plane was given by Paul Kagame himself during a meeting held in Mulindi on March the 31st, 1994.
Kagame said there that no one should be surprised that Rwandan President Juvenal Habyarimana had been assassinated because there had been a war going on. However, a ceasefire, including a date for elections to determine who would govern Rwanda, was in place at the time. The assassinations shattered the fragile peace, and Kagame's army immediately launched a long-planned offensive to finally seize power in Rwanda's capital, as he did during the first week of July. He then changed Rwanda's language of international business from French to English and became a key U.S. and U.K. ally in the region. The U.S. is donor number one to Rwanda, the U.K. donor number two. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, KBFA and Afrobeat Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
The State of Oregon Auditing Office came out last spring with a damning report on the health of the DHS and child welfare system. The thorough report detailed a system wasting about $76 million in lawsuit payouts, system overhauls, and programming. It also detailed a decentralized culture with an overplaced value on autonomy, where screening processes felt short and everyone from CPS workers, caseworkers, and foster parents were overworked and undersupported. KBOO's Zealous Marchant spoke with Kip Mehmet, the audit director of the Secretary of State, and Jamie Rawls, the audit manager, to find out how, in light of the Hart case, the welfare system can do better.
All right. I have in the studio with me Kip Mehmet, the audit director for the Secretary of State's office, and Jamie Rawls, the audit manager. Thank you so much for taking time to come down to KBOO. You recently spearheaded a very large and thorough report on DHS and the welfare system. Do you want to first give us some backstory for our audience about what you do? So how many audits come through your office a year, and what kind of audits?
Good afternoon. Thank you for having us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
This is really aligned with our and the Secretary's sort of citizen-centric approach of auditing. We are, you know, we work for an elected official. We report directly to the citizens. We are their auditor, and we are charged with sort of providing oversight, transparency, and accountability. So getting out in public forums like this really helps us get our message out, so we appreciate being here. As far as the basic overview of the Secretary of State's Audits Division, as I said, every state has a sort of a state audit function, and the one in Oregon is housed in the Secretary of State's office. And so we perform a whole range of audits. Most people, when they think of audits, right, think of IRS and financial audits, and we're not the IRS, but we do a lot of financial auditing, and we have a great team of CPAs and others who kind of do financial audits for the state, look at our overall financial statements, opine on that, do auditing for the federal government on federal grants and stuff like that. But we also do a lot more than that. We have performance auditing. Performance auditing looks sort of at efficiency, effectiveness, economy of public programs, government programs, and they can have wide-ranging scopes. And we also, a component of performance auditing is IT auditing, information technology auditing. Of course, we know cybersecurity and other risks. So we do a whole gamut. We have 75 auditors on staff, all highly trained and credentialed. And we issued the first public audit plan, which kind of, if your listeners want to go to our website, we have that out there, and it's sort of the first publicly issued audit plan of the Secretary of State's office that I know of in recent history, again, where we're trying to be transparent and let the people know, you know, what we're doing. And so that plan, I won't, with limited time, won't go into detail, but it really explains our philosophy. It also lets the whoever's reading it know our criteria for selecting audits. It's we can use a lot of quantifications and, you know, the size of an agency, the budget, the number of employees, those kind of things, but there's a lot of subjective stuff that goes into it too, public relations, emergent policy, and so forth. So we use our professional judgment and some other criteria to determine what we're going to audit. And part of that is talking to key stakeholders, governor's office, starting with them, but also legislators, legislative staff who represent the people, department heads who run our state agencies. But we also, and again, kind of taking it back to this forum, we try to interact with the public. They hire us, we want to know what they want audited. And so we really are looking at innovative ways to lean in and try to hear the public. And I know that's a hard thing to do, but through, you know, community groups and media and others and what, you know, really stay in tune. One of the stereotypes on auditors is they're a day late and a dollar short. They're auditing things that have already happened and are in the rears and kind of said you could do better. What we try to do is get in front of issues. And then also, and I think we'll talk about it later in the interview, we follow up on our audits. And we want to make sure, you know, we just don't issue this report and get, you know, some attention to the matter at hand, as you noted, the foster care. But we want to actually get the problems fixed. And so in our reports, we ask the agencies to respond to our recommendations. We include their response in our report. If they agree with our recommendations, they say who's going to fix it and by when. We follow up, and then we won't do a full audit, but we'll do enough verification to opine if the issue has been resolved. In this foster care audit, as Jamie will get to, there's a lot of recommendations to begin with. A lot of them are around culture, management structure, things like that. So that's hard to easily validate. That's right. Not something that's going to happen overnight, right? And so, but what we can follow up on, we will in a real-time manner, and then we will be issuing a formal follow-up report. May have gone a little too far with you on that.
But. No, that was great. And so you follow up for your audits, and is that really an empowering tool for citizens and legislation to make sure things are followed up on, say in the case of the welfare audit, which we're going to be discussing here in more detail in a couple minutes, you know, when, you know, something as, well, damning comes out and they have such and such amount of time to respond to that, and everyone's hoping that they're actually going to rectify that. Can you really enforce that?
Well, I like the word you just use, enforcement. So auditors, and it's a good thing, it may not sound like that, we don't have any enforcement authority. Mm-hmm. We can't arrest people, we can't take their money away from them, okay. And that's because, you know, we need to be independent. We're not in operations and can't make those decisions. However, to your very good point, and frankly, I'm going to kind of generalize about the auditing profession, a lot of them don't follow up. They'll issue their audit and they'll go away. And then what we see is a lot of things don't get fixed. And, you know, in the real world, audits can bring a lot of pressure. So officials may be inclined to agree with the findings, you know, agree with it, but, you know, maybe not be as motivated. So we really make sure we have real relationships with the people we audit. Mm-hmm. And we spend a lot of time building that trust. You know, we're not here to get you. We're here to report to the citizens and to add value into what you're doing and hopefully help you solve issues. Because in our recommendations, there's a lot of best practice research. We benchmark against other states. We do policy and different kind of literature reviews. We talk to experts around the country. So we have things to add, and we bring that forward. So we believe we provide some help to go forward. So we want them to agree with our findings, but if they don't, we want them to go on public record and say not. So they're not, you know, there's no smoke and mirrors around it. But in the most case, and I don't have the exact number, but we've had agreement over under Secretary Richardson with about 95-96% of our audit recommendations, and that's hundreds of issued. So, but what we want to do to get to the root of your question is we want to really do that formal follow-up. One, to what I think was implied in your question, there's some cynicism around, you know, will these ever get fixed, especially in a report like foster care, where we have decades of problems out there, and some of them are the same. Mm-hmm. And so what we're doing under Secretary Richardson is we're really going to go out there and do the follow-up, as I said, and that entails doing the real work, doing it timely, and actually issuing formal reports. I've been working with the legislature. The Joint Legislative Audit Committee is a committee we report to, and they're open to the idea of us actually briefing those follow-up reports in that legislative body, having the agency there. The idea is, right, it's a good one. It's that we get in there, we issue our audit, we find issues. Unfortunately, audits usually do that. But then the state officials, they raise their hand, they take accountability, and then we follow up, you know, whatever, 6 months, a year later, whenever it makes sense in terms of giving them enough time. And hopefully it's a win-win. We can go before the public. This is how an audit function is supposed to work. We identify issues. They accept it. They fix it. We validate it. We go forward. That's the idea. It doesn't happen all the time, but it does more than the average citizen may believe. And we're really intent. And when we get to those follow-ups where perhaps they haven't, we'll try to understand and be balanced, but we're not going to just walk away at that point. We're going to keep it up, either continue to follow up on the audit, or we're going to wrap it up into what I call a risk assessment for future audit work.
That is really good news to hear about the legislature being receptive to that? Because it seemed like the audit initially came out, there was some pushback as if they didn't really want to, really didn't want to throw money at it. And yet some actually said, well, why don't we just give them more money? But, and I was out on the fence about that, thinking there's just more to this to the story. Why don't we actually read the paperwork on that? From there, what spurred the audit in the first place, the DHS welfare audit?
So I'll let Jamie talk about it. Okay. Just I'll just segue her into it, really. Basically, you know, one, to your first point, you know, these big audits that have complex issues that cost money really to fix, they're distressing. These are our kids. I mean, nobody wants that out there. I'm not saying no one wants it reported, but it's not easy news to hear, especially when you have those chronic issues out there. And then here's the other reality that I think a lot of Oregonians know. We don't have a lot of money, discretionary money. We have a lot of issues across the state that need money. So there's tough choices. These audits will bring things up that, you know, really put a profile on something. So I wouldn't say there was a resistance to it. I think as we went through, I think there was a little bit of a shock value, even though I think people knew we were doing it. But I think once it comes out, it's just in black and white in a big report.
Yeah.
But I would say the legislature has been very receptive, as has the governor's office as well. But to answer your question, it was on our audit plan under the prior administration. That predates me and Secretary Richardson. We executed that audit plan. We used, kind of as I explained in the first part of the segment, you know, our risk assessment process to determine that. One of our philosophies, and I think prior administrations, and it should be for auditors, is these vulnerable populations. You know, if the government's not really making sure they're being treated equitably and fairly and with the best services possible, not many people are outside of, you know, stakeholder groups. And so you will always see social service audits on our audit plan, and they have historically. Mm-hmm. So me and the secretary walked in, we had this plan, we executed it. I'm glad the prior administration had it on the plan. And I don't know if you want to add to that at all, Jamie.
Yeah, just in terms of some things that happened that was on our radar, that was on the media's radar as well, was there had been some scandals in the media with DHS and particularly with child welfare. There was Give Us This Day, which was a state-funded provider that had children in its care, and mismanagement of money. Some things came out in the media. And that was happening in you know, right before we had decided to go in and audit. There was also a lot of upper high-level turnover at the top, which is always distressing, concerning, you know, just to wonder what's happening over there. And then also